Hearing about, that's who we're learning about. How many of you recognize the Beatles? Yeah. A few of us in this room were Beatles generation people. If you were born before the Beatles, I don't mean each of their ages, I mean before they made their debut, lift your hand. All right. We got a few of you. That's why you couldn't sleep and had to come eat breakfast early this morning. But we're glad you're in the room and thankful that you're here. No, really, we are talking about the Nowhere Man because that lyric just keeps ringing so true in my mind and in my ear. I say it, you heard it. He's a real nowhere man sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view. Knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? Well, I don't want you, I don't want me, I don't want us to be nowhere men. I want us to be men who are somebody and who are going somewhere to make a difference. And that's why, as you have seen already today, this promotion on the Man to Man Conference, that this year's Man to Man Conference, the theme is going to be, it's time to lead. And we are calling men out, calling men up, and we've got some incredible leaders, some gifted speakers that are going to be here, as you've seen, and they're going to be a part of this. But today, we're going to go back and continue this study that we've started because we've talked about what is it that leads us to nowhere. And the first thing that we looked at was distraction. We get distracted in life. And those are oftentimes the things that are outside of us. Then we talked last week about defaults. Those are the things that go on inside of us. That's really sort of just living life in the comfort zone. Doesn't really require a lot of me, doesn't challenge me. I just sort of default to certain patterns of behavior and attitudes and action or inactions in my life. And so we talked about that last week. But today, we're going to turn a corner away from those things that take us nowhere and start turning to those things that will take us somewhere and in a direction that we want to go in life. And that all has to do with decisions. The decisions that we make every single day. Rabbi, author, Harold Kushner, best known for his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, said this, "The small choices and decisions we make 100 times a day add up to determining the kind of world we live in." The small choices and decisions that we make 100 times a day add up to determining the kind of world that we live in. By the way, mentioning Rabbi Kushner, what an amazing moment in history this week to see the turnover of the hostages coming back from Gaza and Hamas back to the people of Israel. And it's horrible, horrible and tragic as October the 7th was 2 years ago. I just want to publicly say how incredibly grateful I am for the outcome of this. In May of this year, Connie and I, my wife and I, were at a gathering where we met the parents of Idan Alexander, one of the hostages, a young man released in July of this year. But just being with that family, praying with that family, and knowing the anguish that they have felt, what an amazing thing it has been to see this. But even more than that, the potential for some stability and future peace in the Middle East. And while it will not come without challenges and many changes that are needed, I just want to publicly say how grateful I am for our president's resolve and for the leadership that he has given and for the fact that we are living in a unique day and time to see what we're seeing in this day. And so on behalf of our Jewish friends around the world, we celebrate with them the goodness and the goodwill of what has happened in these days. So, I say that because I quoted Rabbi Harold Kushner. But today, I want to take us back now to the topic, and that is that we talk about our daily decisions that shape our destinies. I heard about a guy who said, we made a decision in our household. And that decision was that every time I say to my wife, honey, where is, or my kids say to their mom, mom, do you know how where I can find, we decided that we would put together something that we called a finder's jar. And every time we do that, we will put $5 in that jar. He said, it's been 13 months, and today we're picking up a new Ford Explorer for my wife. Decisions. Little decisions have big impact, don't they? And many times in life, we fail to estimate and understand the outcome and the consequences of our decisions. I was somewhere in my 30s when a mentor in my life by the name of Dr. George Sweeting made this statement, and I listened to it, I wrote it down, I've repeated it, I've shared it many, many times in my life, and it's this statement. Success in life does not depend on the dreams that you dream, but the choices that you make. Success in life does not depend on the dreams that you dream, but on the choices that you make. It all comes down to decisions, big decisions, small decisions, but decisions. What I'm trying to say to you today is that you are not a victim of your circumstances, but you are the outcome of your choices and your decisions in life. Now, I'm not saying that you haven't faced some really difficult experiences, events, that you haven't had to deal with certain faults and failures, injuries, hurts that have come into your life. And there's no doubt those things have had tremendous impact on how you see life and how you would see yourself. But what I know is this, that for every one of us, it all has to come back to how we're going to see our lives and choose to live our lives. We don't get to write the script of life. But what we do get to choose is that we get to see how God can shape the story to make a difference for good through our lives. Because the most important storyline in your life is the one you tell yourself. I quoted Shane Parrish a good bit last week from his book, Clear Thinking, about some of the defaults. But he made this statement as well. Telling yourself a positive story does not ensure a good outcome. But telling yourself a bad one often guarantees a bad one. You have to decide, what kind of a story am I going to tell about my life? And how am I going to see my life? And how am I going to address the challenges that come? But the problem is, we all have a tendency, don't we, to default to blame. We blame someone else for what happened. We blame an event. We blame an experience. We blame whatever it may be for life. But whenever you blame, you are just being lame. You be lame. That's what you are when you blame. And remember that you don't want to live a lame life. You want to live life to the fullest, and you want to live life with a sense of strength. And so that means that you have to speak to yourself, you have to preach to yourself, you have to correct yourself, and ultimately you have to deal with change in yourself. D.L. Moody once said this, I've never met a man who has given me as much trouble as myself. I've never met a man who has given me as much trouble as myself. And I think we all know and can understand that. Well, in order for us to kind of walk through this decision-making process and some of the things that I think will be helpful and beneficial today, I want to start by comparing and contrasting two people, two men whose stories are told in the Bible, very, very vital stories for each man to know and to understand. And I want us to look at them and how one of them made a wise decision that led to an incredible destiny, and the other one made a foolish decision that frankly led to disaster. One made a decision that shaped his character. The other made a decision that was only exposing the compromise of his life. Who are these two men? One of them's name is Joseph, and his story is told beginning in the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible, chapter 37 to 50. So there are a lot of chapters in the book of Genesis that carry the story of this man, Joseph. The other was a man by the name of David. He was the king of Israel. And David made a decision that's shared in beginning his life story is 1 Samuel 16 through 2 Samuel 24. And in his life, he made a decision of compromise. And this is the illustration that I want us to look at today, the illustration of comparing and contrasting these two lives. Now, when we meet these men, we meet them both as teenagers. We meet them in the budding years of their life as they are growing and developing. We watch them face challenges in their lives. Each of them face a variety of challenges that unfold. We celebrate some amazing successes as we read each of their biographies here in Scripture. We observe their temptations, and then ultimately we trace their outcomes. So let me start with the first one, Joseph. Joseph. In the book of Genesis chapter 37, as I mentioned, we're introduced to Joseph. He's 17 years of age. When we meet this young man, he is a part of a large family. He has 11 brothers, so there are 12 in his family. A lot of sibling rivalry going on there. A lot of competition, a lot of conflict with a bunch of boys in the house. But Joseph was the favored son of his father. In fact, if you don't even know much Bible, you probably have heard of Joseph and his Technicolor dream coat because of a very popular, show. Broadway show that is entitled by that, a play. That's the word I was looking for. And so I couldn't find that play on words. But anyway, that play. And so we learn about the fact that this favored son was given this incredible garment that sort of set him apart from his brothers. Well, because of that, that only infuriated the brothers all the more. They hated him. And Joseph was a young man who had tremendous dreams, tremendous desires and aspirations in his life. And he even told his brothers that he believed that one day he would rule over them. Well, you can imagine if you were the younger brother and you told all the bigger boys that you were going to be their ruler, they weren't exactly excited about that part of the storyline of his life. So there came a day where they had an opportunity to take wrongful advantage of him, and they actually took him while he was away from his father. They put him in a pit, they sold him into slavery, and he was taken off down into Egypt. They went back and told the father that he had been killed by a wild animal, and even brought back that coat dipped in blood to say that Joseph was gone. And so there was great grief in their father, but that just shows you how deep the hatred was that they had for him and the willingness to try to deceive about him. However, because God's plan was unfolding in Joseph's life. Joseph was a young man who sought the Lord. He was a young man who sought to live out the plan of God in his life. And so ultimately, he was sold into the house of one of the leading men in Egypt by the name of Potiphar. And Potiphar was a big dude and a big deal, and he had a lot that he was an overseer of, but he saw the potential, he saw the incredible ability that was there in Joseph's life, and he actually made him the manager over all of his household and all of his goods. So now we pick up the story. Genesis chapter 39, the Bible says in verse 1, Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was the head of the household. But let me now begin picking up in verse 6. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. That is, Joseph was a completely kept man. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. He was one good-looking dude. I mean, just, he was a man's man. Everything about him, he was chiseled, he was strong, he was incredible. And the Bible says, and after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. Is he not greater in this house than I am? Nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And she spoke to Joseph day after day. This wasn't a one and done. This wasn't a quick encounter that happened once. No, every day as he was trying to do his job, his duties, she became a distraction, and that distraction was seduction. And the Bible says that ultimately he refused and said, how can I sin against God? And then she spoke to Joseph day after day, but he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, to be with her. Now that's a very difficult position, wouldn't you say? But it's something we all know, isn't it? Because every day in our lives, we have someone somewhere trying to seduce our attention, not because we look like Joseph, but because we're willing to either indulge some money or to give some attention or whatever it may be. But we live in a world where this happens every single day to every man in this room. Not in the exact context, but certainly within the, with the same pretext of trying to get him to compromise himself. Ultimately, just quickly, I don't have time to walk through this and read through it all. There was a day that she decided she'd sneak up on Joseph and grab him, and she did. And Joseph decided the only thing he could do was to try to get away. And so he literally pulled away. And as he did, the kind of overlay garment that he had pulled away. And she was left standing there holding it. And of course, being a woman scorned in a moment that she absolutely refused to consider the shame of what happened, she began to cry out and to say, Joseph has tried to take advantage of me. Joseph has tried to come on to me. And the result was that Potiphar fired him and had him put in prison because he was the captain of the guard. Joseph goes to prison. He spends some time there. But just like when he got to Potiphar's house, the head of the prison realized this guy Joseph was such an incredible man, he brought him up and gave him responsibility over all of the prison. And so he became the most prominent prisoner. And then after that, there came a moment in the midst of it where he later not only did what he did, but he interpreted some dreams. And after he interpreted those dreams, one of the men who had been with him in prison ended up being in the presence of Pharaoh and told Pharaoh about this man Joseph who could interpret dreams because Pharaoh was having trouble sleeping. In the end, Joseph ended up being brought out of the prison, being put in the presence of Pharaoh, and he ultimately became the second most powerful man in all of the world, the known world of Egypt and the Egyptian kingdom in that day. And when it was all said and done, proven again and again, his character, though things didn't work out the way that he would have thought that they would. And every time you see Joseph thinking that he's going to ascend, he somehow seems to descend and to have to deal with difficulty in his life. But when a famine came to Egypt, and when his own family had to come back and one day stood in his presence where he had the power to have total revenge, he said this in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20. He says, as for you, you meant this evil against me, but God meant it for good. And then he went on to say that many people would be kept alive as they are today. You meant this to me for evil, but God used it. And the story of Joseph is one of the most incredible stories of character in all of the Bible. It's a picture of faith and faithfulness, resistance, and a mindset of life that says, I can't do this. Why? Why did Joseph say he couldn't do it? He didn't say he couldn't do it because of Potiphar. He said, I can't do this because of my relationship with God. Right. He didn't ever think for a moment, Potiphar will never know. He always thought God will always see. And so that's what we see in the life of Joseph. Now let's flip over to the book of Samuel, and there we meet David. Another amazing man. Of course, you know that you've heard the story about David, that when he was a young man, just a teenager, that he went out to the battlefield, and when all of the other soldiers were afraid and when none of them would face this giant, David was the one who was willing to go and to face Goliath, and God used that moment to define him. It was a moment of faith and character. And then David ascended to the throne, ultimately, of Israel. And that whole story is an amazing story of watching him in little moments make all kinds of decisions. But then we jump into the story. Once he's king, once he's in the palace, once he's living the successes of his life, we jump into that story in the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 11, verse 1, and it says this, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab. There's a hint right there. The kings go out to battle. But King David decided, you know what? I don't need to go this year. I'm going to send somebody else. He sent Joab and his servants with him and all of Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. And it happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and he said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, and then she returned to her house, and then the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." Here we see a man who had every reason to defend the character of his life because of the goodness and the blessing of God. But he was a man who allowed a distraction and a default in his life to create an indulgence, not resistance, but indulgence. And ultimately, in the process of that, to bring disaster on his character through compromise. The story of David is, at this moment, is an incredible story of sadness and a story of indulgence. David thought, like so many of us do, "I've got this." Joseph thought, "I can't do this." But David thought, "I got this." And then even when he got word that there was an outcome that he had not expected to happen, David decided that he would do what we all do in that moment. "I can fix this." And so you know what he did? Once he knew what had happened, he had Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, probably one of his chief warriors, come home, gave him a leave of absence, and said, "Just go spend some time with your wife." What was he trying to do? He was trying to create a cover story. And the outcome of that cover story was that ultimately Uriah was a man of character. Uriah refused to go home and be with his wife while the soldiers were in the field of battle. And as a result, David sent him back to the battlefield, had him put on the front line. He literally set it up so that Uriah was murdered, was killed. It was murder from the heart of David, killed in the field of battle. And what a tragic story it is to see the death that comes because of that sin of indulgence. The death that created the cover story, the death of the fact that the baby that was conceived died. And then if you go and read the remainder of the life story of David, it is just one bit of unraveling after another, one moment of brokenness after another, one moment of shame after another, because David defaulted his character for compromise. David gave in to distraction and to default. James says in the book of James, chapter 1, talking about the problem of testing and temptation, it says this. It says, "Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. And then when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, gives birth to death." Every day in your life, you and I are making decisions like Joseph and like David. And those decisions are either to allow a faith that we claim to give us the power to have resistance. In fact, Paul even wrote about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18. He said, "Run from sex sin. No other sin affects the body as this does. You, when you sin in this manner, you sin against your own body." The scripture over and over says, you've got to either choose a path of running and resisting the things that would bring compromise to your life and your character, or else you will give indulgence. But know this, there will always be consequence. There will always be payment. There will always be injury. There will always be death. Thomas Merton said it this way, Since no man ever can or could live by himself or for himself alone, the destinies of thousands of other people are bound to be affected, some remotely, but some very directly and near at hand, by my choices and decisions and desires, as my own life would also be formed and modified according to theirs. Your life affects others. You don't have to be a big prominent person to have a big impact of destruction in the lives of others around you, or to destroy yourself. And so I'm using the illustration of two men in the Bible, and a very vivid illustration that every man in this room can relate to. But this is broken down into a variety of different challenges and choices that every one of us face every day in our lives, and the importance of being able to understand how to deal with this. The decisions that you and I make today and in the days to come will either result in greater blessedness or greater brokenness in our lives and in the lives of others around us. So that's just the illustration. That's something I think you can at least see and understand and relate to. Now let me get to what I would call the instruction. The instruction that I want to focus on and give you today about decisions. Because the instruction that I am trying to promote and prompt in your life is a series of daily decisions that are based upon, ultimately, your desire for character and a commitment to self-control, not allowing fears and desires and emotions to dominate your life, but to give your attention and your energies to what matters the most in life. So here's the question. How can I live decidedly? How can I make decisions, and how can I live decidedly, and how can I be a man of character rather than a man of compromise? Number one, clarify your values. Clarify your values. Know what matters in life, because ultimately what you value does shape the decisions and choices that you make every day. And when you get out of alignment, when you are out of alignment inwardly between what you, on the one hand, claim matters to you, and yet on the other hand, you keep allowing or compromising and allowing to matter to you, it creates tremendous stress and anxiety in your life. Many men are living in two worlds. You're living in the world of what you profess to be, and then you're living in the world that you have indulged and that you're allowing to be. And so it is important that you clarify your values. Roy Disney, the brother of Walt, said this: decision making is easy when you clarify your values. Decision making is easy. And when you choose to focus on character building rather than comfort seeking life, it changes everything. Change happens in every one of our lives when one of three things happens. Change happens when we hurt enough that we have to, when we know enough that we want to, or when we have enough that we're able to. First, when we hurt enough that we have to. Many times that happens with a doctor. You go see a doctor, he does some blood work, and he comes back and says, you know what? You're a diabetic. The rest of your life, you're going to have to deal with managing your blood sugar and what's going on in you, because it has the capacity to bring catastrophic physical effects to your life and debilitation to your life. And many times when you have a moment like that, you suddenly decide, you know what? I got to change my diet. I got to change my habits. I got to change the way that I put my patterns in place in life, because something happens to you that forces change in your life. It can happen when you lose a job. It can happen when you go through a broken relationship. But things in life happen to us, and the hurt of that brings about the need for change. And those are the times when we tend to change in our lives. But the question is, when we face those moments, are we going to keep drifting and defaulting, or are we going to chart a new course? Are we going to make good decisions about the future? I can tell you how you can know if you make a bad decision. J.C. Ryle said it this way. I think you'll find this interesting. J.C. Ryle said six ways to know you're making bad decisions. Number one, you avoid input from people you respect. Number two, you don't consult the Word of God. Number three, you don't pray for God's leading. Number four, it doesn't build you spiritually. Number five, it undermines your integrity. And number six, it leads you to temptation. It leads you to compromise instead of reinforcing character. Those are six ways to know that you are making a bad decision, because they are deviating from the values that are essential in your life, if in fact you want to be a man of God and a man who honors God. David cheated and he paid the price. Joseph resisted and experienced a level of impact and blessing beyond anything that he could have imagined. God sees the secret moments of your life. He sees the secret moments of compromise. But let me tell you something else, guys. He sees the secret moments of character. And when you make a character choice to pursue God's way and God's standard and God's purpose for your life, you will find that God works in your life in a way that you never imagined. Otherwise, you're on your own. And on your own, I promise you, just like D.L. Moody said, you will never meet a man who will cause more problems in your life than you. Secondly, not only must we clarify our values, but we have to identify our weaknesses. Identify our weaknesses. Another critical aspect of decisive living is to know yourself and to understand what causes you to choose default and indulgence, to understand when you're susceptible to the lure of temptation in your life, to understand that there are weaknesses and there are blind spots, that if you do not pay attention to them, they are sure to bring great consequence and great injury in your life and in the lives of others. Blind spots. I just read that there was a study done and just published here in September about the impact of backup cameras on automobiles. And do you know that they have now done a study to determine that since 2018, there has been a 78% drop in the number of children who have been killed by automobile accidents of people backing up, 78%. And that there have been, that they have fallen injuries by someone being bumped or hit, injuries of other people have dropped by one half. Why? Because they took away the blind spots. And if you're going to make good decisions in your life, you've got to get rid of the blind spots. You've got to see them. You've got to see the moments of life where you are vulnerable, where you're susceptible, where seduction or where some compromising opportunity comes and that you are ready to respond to it. There are a number of articles. There are many things that you can read on this. But one of the things that has been identified in our psychology is that many of us have addiction triggers and that there are some recovery protocols that we need to put in place if we're not going to live by distraction and by default, whatever the behaviors may be. And I know I've set this up around talking about sexual sin and temptation using David and Joseph, but I'm talking about all these areas of life because all of us have these triggers that quickly allow us to indulge ourselves and to get off course. What are they? You may have heard these before, but I think they matter. It's a simple little acronym called HALT, H-A-L-T, H-A-L-T, HALT. We are susceptible to failure and compromise. One, when we are hungry. When you're hungry. Hey, every man in here knows food's just one of the greatest things in life, isn't it? I mean, that's why you came. You know I know you didn't come to hear me. You came for that big breakfast you got this morning, and it was free, and I'm grateful that we can make that available. Now, let me say that if you want to help us with it, we would sure appreciate it. That's a lot of breakfasts over the course of 4 weeks, and you can make a gift to the church and just put on it Forum, Men's Forum, but I say that to say I want you to be here, and if getting food in your belly will get you to the table, then I'm grateful to get you around the table because I think it matters. But hunger is a huge trigger in our lives that when we're hungry, there's a need for both emotional and physical satisfaction. It has been well documented that when people are hungry, that there is difficulty in making good decisions. Don't you think Costco knows this? Why do you think they give you taste test of all their products? So that you will get home a month later and say, why do I still have 36 packets of that thing that I just tasted at Costco? Because you were hungry. And when you tasted it, you thought, well, I'm going to buy a big box of it. Well, that's the only way they sell it anyway. And so I say that to say that hunger is an amazing thing because when we are nutrient deprived, the prefrontal cortex where rational thought and impulsive behavior can happen, it gets blurred. And as a result, we end up making decisions that are based on our mood and our attitude. And of course, we all know about people being hangry. And when they're hangry, they have trouble concentrating. They have anxiety, irritability, and just general uneasiness. So what is the key word when it comes to being hungry? Simple, beef. You need some meat. You need to eat, man. Make sure that in your life that you're not allowing, and I'm speaking to myself here, that we're not allowing our emotional needs to be met by just giving in to whatever may satisfy the taste, though it may ultimately add to the breakdown of the body. Hungry. Secondly, when you're angry. One of the other ways in which many times we go to compromise in our life is when we're angry. Anger is a powerful emotion that rises in all of us. It may really quickly spill out of some. Some of you are like a bottle of Coca-Cola. You shake it, boom, it's ready to explode. Others of you are more just like something that just begins to burn and melt down in the inside. But we all deal with anger, and it's a burning reality in our lives. In the Bible, in the book of Ephesians, Paul wrote this, "Be angry," we're going to be angry, "but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger," and listen to this, "and give no opportunity to the devil." Why do you think he wrote that? Because you are never more susceptible to doing something impulsive and out of order and indulgent than when you are angry and you do not deal with your anger. That's right. Unchecked anger in our lives creates turmoil and opens the door for us to act out and to indulge ourselves. There's a husband who said to his wife, "When I get mad at you, you don't ever argue with me. You don't ever seem to get mad at me. You always seem to control your anger. How do you do that?" She said, "It's simple. I just go and clean the toilet." He said, "What?" He said, "How does that help?" She said, "I use your toothbrush." It's all down to how you handle the anger in your life, brothers. Ask yourself the question, why am I angry? Will my anger lead me to make choices that are not in line with my values? Will my anger enable default to my weaknesses? When it comes to anger, the key word is balance. So am I hungry? Am I angry? The next one is, am I lonely? Lonely. Loneliness is a major trigger and a contributor, allowing distractions and defaults to dominate our lives and our choices. And isolation and loneliness is a tactical advantage of our enemy, the devil. Listen to what Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 5. He says, or chapter 5, verse 8, I'm sorry. He says, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour." What do you think that means, prowls around like a roaring lion? Have you ever seen a lion track a meal? How do they do it? They look for the one that is the most vulnerable and susceptible, and they go after that one. The one that can be isolated, the one that is lonely. And you need to be careful about the loneliness of your life and the impact of that loneliness on you. One study has been written and says that loneliness is perhaps one of the most significant and commonly cited triggers for relapse. Addiction thrives in isolation. Active addiction often leads to damaged relationships, burned bridges, a retreat from social connections. In early recovery, individuals might feel isolated even when physically around others, struggling to reconnect with healthy friends and family, or finding themselves alone with difficult emotions that they use substances and indulgences to avoid. Are you lonely? Have you allowed yourself to be isolated? The answer, the key word to that is brothers. You need brothers in your life. And that's why we have Men's Forum. That's why we do Momentum. That's why we do life groups as a church. That's why we have times of helping men to get together. It helps to get together, to be together, to fight together. And you need brothers. And then the last thing is tired. Are you tired? Because when you're tired, when you're fatigued, chronic fatigue and sleep deprivation can be a significant obstacle in addiction and a silent saboteur in your life. Your ability to cope with stress is diminished, your emotional regulation is weaker, and your ability to recover is lowered. So halt. Am I hungry? Am I angry? Am I lonely? Am I tired? Because I promise you, every one of those can be a blind spot, a vulnerability that can bring damage and destruction into your life and into the lives of people around you. If you're tired, the key word there is boundaries. Boundaries. You got to have some boundaries in your life. You've got to create patterns that help you to get the rest and the exercise and the things that are needed to maximize your strength. It was Aristotle who said, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. And knowing yourself means that you're going to be careful to do these things. Well, I really don't have time to go any further. We're on the mark. I want to make the two final statements that I have here for you. This is the turning point for us. Number one, Paul Tillich said, decision is a risk rooted in courage of being free. Decision is a risk rooted in the courage of being free. And if you want to be free from anything in your life that has become a bondage, it's going to require a decision. And then W.A. Peterson said, you are only one decision away from a totally different life. One decision. For the good or for the bad? For the Joseph or for the David? And I just want to challenge you to start making good decisions. But to make a decision is one thing. To live out that decision is another. And that's going to be our final thing that we focus on next week. So my parting thought today is simply this. It's on your card. Don't give up good character for cheap pleasure. Don't give up good character for cheap pleasure. I'll see you next week. Thanks for being here today.